Welcome to Success Beneath the Surface, hosted by Deborah Fell, Managing Partner at Chief Outsiders. Deborah provides insights specifically for CEOs from growth-oriented companies.
Thank you, Susan. My guest today is Kyle Bucket, retired U.S. Navy SEAL who, during his military career, completed missions too numerous to mention, and each one with many lives under his command on the line, as well as our nation's security. We thank him for his service. He's been a board member, former COO and CHRO of a publicly traded company, and has been instrumental in the development of numerous Navy SEAL-founded businesses. Having lived and learned leadership and culture in highly complex environments, to say the least, he co-founded CultureForce with his business partners to provide companies with tools to create positive culture change, and also co-wrote Leadership is Overrated on creating self-leading teams that win. I'm honored to have Kyle as my guest today. Kyle Bucket, I'm so glad to have you on the show. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And it's not just because you've written this really cool book with a really special name, Leadership is Overrated, but it's because of who you are, the things you've done, and the message that you have to bring to this audience of CEOs that we have here today. So let's start with that. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're working on these days, and how you got from where you started to where you are today.
I appreciate it. Yeah. So I fought against evil for decades, right? With weaponry, with tactics, with violence, pure violence. And here's the thing. I've always been an idealist. And then in the midst of war, I had kids. I became a parent.
Wow.
And I wanted to create a bright future. It's funny, you know, Deborah, my wife and I, we got married in 2005. And for the first almost 10 years of our marriage, my life expectancy was, you know, 3 months-ish.
Wow.
And so we held off on, you know, becoming parents.
Yeah.
We were very thoughtful of, hey, let's wait a little bit. Let's see how this kind of plays out for us before I leave you a widow with kids. That's for better or for worse, whether it was a wise decision or not, I'm not going there. I'm just saying that was the decision we made.
Yeah.
And so, you know, years later, I finally become a parent. I'm holding my kids in my arms and I'm saying to myself, I want a brighter future.
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, years later, I could use my experiences to help create that we could refine and create positive cultures that really attract great people.
Before you go on, you spoke about violence and war, and you say a little bit more about that.
Oh, sure. Sorry. I spent 20 years in the military. Majority of my time was in leadership within the Navy SEAL community. I had a wonderful career. I got to do a lot of fun stuff, everything from, you know, single man operations all the way up to my largest operation, which was an 800 man clearance operation in southern Afghanistan, and a lot of things in between. You know, I always joke that everyone always thinks of the Navy SEALs as running and gunning and blowing stuff up
Yes.
and chasing bad guys, which we do that. We do it, and we do it extremely well, but we also run the enterprise. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're running the global supply chain, the logistics, the infrastructure development, the safety protocols, training protocols, executing training, and on and on and on. I mean, infrastructure development projects. I was actually an instrumental executive in a very large military construction project that exceeded $1.6 billion. And so, you know, we do a lot outside of, you know, what you might see on TV or in the movies, right? I realized that I could use that experience to help, you know, create a better world.
Yes. And, you know, there's maybe not, at least in the exposure that I have on a database basis, is pretty much the news, you know, vis-a-vis the wars and the activities that are going on out there. There's not a lot of talk about leadership in that environment or theater, you know, as I hear them describe. But as you're talking about this, it dawns on me that that's where leadership is a matter of life and death.
Right.
Leadership and strategy, and these are things where those skills are present to some extent likely already, but are truly honed in a way that would benefit us all to learn about and to hear your experience and how you have begun to think about leadership, which is where I think you were going before I had jumped in to talk about war and violence.
It's interesting, right? Because I come from a community where we view leadership at every level. We lean on each other at every single level, and we get to witness this amoeba of leadership at every single level. And what I mean by that is, even though we are the military, even though we are the elite form of the military, we do have different levels of leadership at the same rank. And let me break that down for you for a little bit. Meaning, if you know you have a captain and another captain, well, they're both the same rank, but one's in charge, right? You have a commander and a commander, both same rank, but you know, one's in charge. Or sometimes what we see in special forces is you have what we call positional authority, meaning Deborah is a lower rank than Kyle, but Deborah's in charge. That actually will happen from time to time. And so I realized, you know, great people working together really makes elite teams. And when you have elite teams, you have organizations that become elite. And these organizations, when they're working at an elite level and they're striving for excellence in their missions, the world is a much better place. And so that's kind of how we landed on, you know, writing our book. Chris and I became friends, and I'm jumping ahead, but I'll come back to where I'm going with this. Chris and I became friends, and it was wonderful to hear of his experiences at Dave Ramsey organization and kind of contrast those with my experiences in elite warfighting and what we can learn from both. And then actually, it's kind of funny, Deborah, you know, my wife owns a hair salon. Uh-huh. Actually, she owns several hair salons.
Oh, wow.
And she's actually developing her own beauty line as well. So you have this complete triangle of completely different ends of the spectrum.
Yes.
Where we can learn different styles of leadership, of communication between all of those. Because working with, this is might sound stereotype, but, you know, working with, for my wife, you know, in her world, working with very Bravo type individuals as opposed to like my world, which is very alpha male, extreme opposites end of the spectrum, you can learn a lot from both sides. So
yeah, another form of diversity. Absolutely.
That's right. That's right.
And, learning from one another. So you were saying that, you know, after you and your wife had your children, you began to dream about or want to take action to create a better world. Say more about that.
Well, for me, I started realizing that I'm going to sound like a salesman here for a second, but just bear with me. I started realizing that 85% of America hates their job and hates their boss. And it all kind of dawned on me back in 2017. I had a very unique experience. In 2017, I got to do an executive trip, an executive tour with a bunch of my buddies from the SEAL teams, where we went up to Silicon Valley. And over the course of 3 or 4 days, we got to visit Oracle, Facebook, Dropbox, Instagram, Airbnb, several other smaller startups, and then several others, you know, right around the Valley and Sand Hill Road, et cetera, et cetera. And over the matter of 2 to 3 days, because we would go into one organization and we'd spend 3 hours there.
Yeah.
And then we'd go spend 3 hours at Oracle and then drive across town and spend 3 hours at Facebook. Fun side note, I'll never forget walking into Facebook and I was like, man, I feel old. Everyone here is so young. Everyone's so young. I'll never forget 3 hours at one, 3 hours in another, 3 hours at a third place. And in an instant, and very quickly, you got to feel the differences of the culture, okay, the differences of the organizations. It was like a wall that would hit you, like a scent, if you will, that would just smack you in the face when you walked into these organizations and you could feel the difference. And I became very attuned to it because I had been attuned to it for the last, up to this point, almost a decade now. And we'll get to that in a moment.
Oh, wow.
But I was like, wow, this is really fascinating, getting to feel the difference in a place that is so historically cliche, if you will, of an organization. You know, there's that saying where an engineer will spend 2 to 3 years in Google, then they'll go 2 to 3 years to Facebook, then they'll go 2 to 3 years at Oracle, then 2 to 3 years at Dropbox, and then they'll just repeat the cycle, right? So you would think that a lot of these organizations would feel the same.
Yes.
But
yeah,
they don't. You couldn't be further from the truth. They're completely different. It really stuck with me on, wow, we can use our experiences to help drive, you know, lasting change, effective change in these organizations.
Mm-hmm. And so with this particular group, though, was this the group that you then created your company with?
No, it was not. It just so happened that myself and several Navy SEALs were going through a transition period, transitioning from the military to private sector.
Yes.
And so there's some programs out there. One of, you know, I'm an ambassador of one, which is called the Honor Foundation. And what they do is they'll take guys, like they'll do a trek like what I just mentioned and put the guys and gals through, you know, an executive course. So we went over up there after the end of the executive course, and it was great. It was a wonderful time.
Yeah, that's great. What a great experience for you all, but also for the companies that you visited, because I'm sure they wanted to hear your read. They wanted to benefit from your experience and your observations, or at least hopefully they did.
Right. Yeah, it was wonderful. It reminded me back in where this all kind of stemmed from was back in 2010, 2011. 2010, I get tasked by the Obama administration to go conduct village stability operations in Afghanistan.
Okay.
And village stability operations are a very, very unique, and I talk about it in the book, but it's a very unique situation in the fact that you're going to work by, through, and with the local population to establish democracy in the region. So unlike our normal mission, which is, you know, mostly direct action, targeting, going after, you know, bad guys, foreign actors, etc. This mission was very unique in the sense that we were going to go and work by, through, and with the local population by, you know, developing infrastructure, building roads and bridges, irrigation. You know, it's completely different. So as I'm getting tasked with this, I get attached to a platoon, and on their very last 2 weeks of their deployment, their hero, their rock star, their Captain America, his helicopter gets shot down on his very last mission. And so he passes, and the guys are obviously mourning. Everyone's frustrated. We come back from that deployment, and I walk into the platoon space, and I go, hey, guys, the people that just killed your best friend, the people that just killed your Captain America, the people that you might want some vengeance against, guess what? We're going to go sleep alongside them. We're going to go have dinner with them. We're going to go back to the area. We're going to, not the exact area, but same country.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to go back, and we're going to live alongside and live by,
wow,
through and with helping them to build and establish democracy, helping them to build security force, a police force, and on and on and on. So they didn't want to hear that.
I was going to ask
imagine.
How that went. Yeah.
It went over like a wet blanket. So I had to take a step back and go, okay, how are we going to do this? How are we going to change the dynamics within the platoon? How are we going to change the culture to go over there and change another culture? So it was like, how do I change an environment, a culture, to then go and change another culture? And I didn't have my book, shameless plug, but I didn't have any books at the time. You know, Dan Coyle's Culture Code had not come out yet. There wasn't really anything out there that I could really lean on. And so I just grabbed what I could, learned what I could, and then did what I could.
CEOs need help growing their companies, but don't always have the time or money to hire a full-time chief marketing officer, CMO, or chief sales officer, CSO, or both. Recruiting a quality full-time executive can take months, not to mention the ongoing cost. In these challenging times, CEOs need battle-tested growth executives who can help companies successfully navigate the uncertain waters. Partner with Chief Outsider CMOs and CSOs who will function as strategic operators to build and execute your growth engines.
You know, I did, and will. It's not so shameless at all because you have value to bring. But I did just get this actually, and in the introduction, you talk about the ship that got frozen in the ice, and how nobody was listening, to the
Well done.
person who could really provide some great advice on what to do. And I'm not going to spoil it or talk about it. You're welcome to do so. But it sounds like that leadership steps in when leadership. Somebody has to take leadership. They have to assume that position. But you're also, in some ways, it sounds like to me, and you know, please illuminate me and everybody else here, the part of what you're talking about is more than one leader. We're talking
Right.
about a team that leads and individuals on that team stepping up to leadership versus having one leader that has to direct. But certainly what you're describing in that platoon meeting, you were kind of taking the leadership position as to what we needed to go do. So talk a little bit about those two points, someone taking the leadership position, and also what you want is not just one leader.
To take a step back, every situation's different. Every organization is different. Every entity, every business, any state, company, city, etc., government, every situation's different. And so, what we try to focus on is, yeah, you're right. There does initially need to be someone in charge or a framework in charge, no doubt about it. But what we're trying to help the reader, what we're trying to help organizations that we work with is saying, hey, you can kill the leader. And what that means is if your organization is just going to go completely under because you die, then really how strong was the organization, right? And so I'm no longer in the military, right? Some of our greatest admirals and generals are no longer in the military, although we extremely appreciate all of their hard work, all of their efforts. The military is so incredible because it does just continue to thrive on, right? You can name hundreds and thousands of organizations that the initial founder, the initial CEO is no longer at the helm, right? We see that all the time. And those are the companies that really become generational in an incredible way. And so what we're talking about is saying, hey, once you initially, to your point, hey, Kyle stepped in and Kyle was leading and helping. Yes, however, comma, it wasn't that long before eventually I got to a point where I had kind of removed myself, and I talk about it in the book, where I had removed myself to enable the next several guys to step up and elevate their game into those leadership roles. And the reason why we focus on that is we say, hey, if you get to a place where you can start replacing yourself with others and you can help to lift them up to the next place of leadership, then you can go out there and elevate yourself. Meaning, you can go out and now focus on vision. Now you can focus on strategy. Now you can focus on the next ridgeline and what you want to try and accomplish. So many times today, we just see this kind of rice bowl, if you will, from leaders that just want to kind of hold on to, the authority and not delegate and not spread authority throughout their team.
Right. I love this, and I want to come back to this point. So we'll put a bookmark on that point. I though want to go back to the platoon and hear the end of the story, if there's an end of the story at this point. So you get many stepping up, you go back to the country.
We got to kind of back it up even further. So, first things first, what we had to do was establish trust, right? Because I'm walking in to the platoons. No one knows me really. A couple of the guys did, but loosely, didn't know me that well. And so there were several guys that I had to earn their trust. I had to earn their respect. And if you come out right out of the gate, start talking about, hyperboles and theoretical and how you want to, we don't care about any of that. Can you just shoot straight? Right? Can you jump out of a plane correctly? Can you take down a village or a building or orchestrate a mission and do mission planning correctly? And so many times today, we see that where a leader doesn't want to just prove to the team at a basic fundamental level
Yes.
that they're capable and earn trust first things first, you have to earn trust.
Yes.
And you can't do that. It is very challenging to do that if you're not capable in the basics, right? So first you have to showcase, hey, I am first things first, capable. I am not a knucklehead. I'm not a madman. I'm not running around screaming at people. My empathy, my listening is not fake. I do actually care about the team. I do care about accountability. I do care about trust. And I could on and on and on. First things first is earning trust, right? And then after that, you can go, okay, now, once I've earned trust, now everyone's trusting each other, not just me, but they're also trusting each other, because that doesn't happen overnight. Especially in corporate America, we see it every day where there's a lot of backstabbing. Now, let's define as a team, not me as a leader, but as a team, now that we've established trust, now let's define on what we want to do, who we want to be, and where we want to get to. And then, to your point, to your question, okay, now we've established trust. Now together as a team, everyone has had buy-in on this process. Everyone understands, hey, now let's all come together to define where we're going and what we want to do and what we want to be. Once it's then defined, then you can go, okay, now let's develop it. Now let's put it together. Now let's grow a self-led team. Now let's start putting policies in place. Now let's start putting procedures in place. Let's start scaling. And then from there you would get into, you know, what we call sustainment, which is then, okay, now let's start creating more and more leaders.
Yes. Yeah. There's no skipping steps here.
That's right. That's right. It can happen. We've seen it happen as quick as a month and then all the way up to, you know, a decade.
Yeah.
So everyone's different.
Yeah. You know, I very much believe in what you're saying. I don't understand it from the environment that you, well, I know I understand what you're saying, but I've not been in that environment. But I have always sought to be a great leader and sought to bring leadership into my teams and done many different things to, and invested, you know, in order to do that. And I've said many a time to members of my team, when I was looking for an angle, you know, to really open up the aperture on this. And I remember saying, you know, I can find many great people to do the activities or to do the thing that you are tasked to do. What is very difficult to find are leaders who understand not just the task, but the leadership involvement. So I share that only to say I am really passionate about this topic myself. And I'm so glad that we're getting a chance to talk about it and gain your perspective on this today.
You know, it's interesting to me because tell me I'm wrong. I'd love to, like, let's have a discussion around this concept because I love talking about this. What's interesting to me today is that we see this every day. We see organizations that hire, there's this buzzword from my cohorts, if you will, in the CHRO world.
Okay.
You hear this buzzword, which is, hey, we hire for culture fit. We hire for culture fit. We hire, and I'm just like, oh, I just give an eye roll because it's everyone's trying to find a puzzle. It's like they're trying to find a puzzle piece to fit into their puzzle. And what we say at Culture Force is we hire for culture improvement, not culture fit. We don't want to hire to fit in. We want to hire to improve, to elevate the organization. And so to your point is we always, when we're working with, you know, hiring managers, et cetera, we say, hey, we got what, to your point, we see, we understand exactly what you need from a technical standpoint, you know, especially as it pertains to, you know, a software engineer, a mechanical engineer, something that's very, very, you know, linear to a degree. But when it comes to, you know, elevating the team, when it comes to elevating the capabilities of the entire team, not just that individual need, that one of one, we go, hey, if that person or that individual is not as capable from a discipline perspective as opposed to a culture improvement leadership perspective. There's a big difference.
Yes, yes.
Simultaneously, can you elevate from within to what we were talking about earlier? Well, Sally across the room, maybe she's not the best software engineer on the planet, but man, look at how everyone rallies around her. What is that? Oh, and then it's always like, oh, what is it? Oh, she's empathetic. She listens. She actually cares.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Sally's not just about Sally.
Right, yeah. Right. She wants the entire team buzzing together, vibing off of each other, syncing off of each other, communicating in a transparent manner. Wow, that's incredible. Look what that just did for that team. So without having every single organization's different, right? And so without having the exact full spectrum, the full understanding of the situation, it sometimes is kind of hard to go into, you know, for me anyway, it sometimes is challenging to go in hyperboles or scenarios, fake scenarios.
Let's jump back to the place we bookmarked, because sure. you were talking about something very, very important in the sense that, you know, if you're a leader of any team, and if for some reason you walk away or something happens to you and the team falls apart, well, that's not really how leaders do it. You didn't say it exactly like that. And the reason why I want to come back to it was you were talking about raising up or inspiring or getting people to see themselves and step into leaders, but not as in a bunch of Lone Ranger leaders, but as a team together to create impact in the world or whatever it is they're focused on. And it made me think about succession planning because I think about this a lot, because is it really succession planning? Or is it really raising these leaders or inspiring these leaders? Because you can have many people to succeed into a position. You can have, like, you know, not just one, the chosen one. You can Right. have plentiful leaders that can Right. just seamlessly step in and continue to move the business forward. Am I off base on this, or does that?
No, you're exactly right. One of my favorite scenarios in the SEAL teams is during the training cycle. So we're getting ready to, as we're training and getting ready for our deployment overseas, what we'll do is say we're out in a fake village that, you know, we built. It's yes. a fake mock-up village that we're practicing our drills through, right? We'll be doing, you know, simulation, fake bullets, that kind of thing. And in the training scenario, one of the training cadre will walk over to, you know, me, or if I'm the training cadre, I'll walk over to, you know, the leading officer in charge or the leading tactician, the leading chief petty officer. And I'll go, hey, John Doe, you now just got shot in the head. You're now dead. Play dead. And what's fascinating, we do it all the time. And what's fascinating in that scenario is you get to see very quickly what happens when the leader gets killed. Does the next guy elevate? Does the guy above him understand what's going on? Is there constant communication? Does the entire team around them understand what's going on now? And how does he step into that? How does he or she step into that role? And what's fascinating is three things happen. The leader understands how good of a job he has been doing training the subordinate very quickly. The subordinate understands how good of a job he's been doing absorbing the leader's training. And then the one that probably matters the most, everyone else understands how capable the next guy is, should the leader get killed, and they all witness it and they all see it. And because of them seeing it, because of them witnessing, everyone understands. And it could be a culture killer. I've seen this really, really kill cultures too. It could be really detrimental, because then all of a sudden it creates this weird dynamic where it's like, well, this guy wasn't doing his job. This guy wasn't doing his job. We were doing our job, but, like, what can we do? Because no one's delegating, no one's passing authority, and on and on and on, right? And so you got to be really, really careful about this. What we'll do in, you know, corporate America you know, we'll work with like an executive assistant, and she or he will know. Maybe, you know, a COO or maybe a CHRO will know, and then, but no one else from the team will know. And, you know, on Tuesday morning, all of a sudden, CEO's phone is off, CEO's email's off, no one can get a hold of him. He's dead. AKA, he's sitting on a beach with a Mai Tai in the Bahamas, but no one can get a hold of him. We kill his communication, and then we get to sit there and we critique, and we're writing all of our notes on, and we're just sitting there writing all these notes and saying, hey, look what happened. Let's digest this. Let's do an after action and see how this actually worked. And in that scenario, you can learn a lot, right? You really get to see a lot, how everyone reacts.
It's really interesting because, again, you really inspire a lot of thinking here. You know, you have the person who's the existing leader. You have the other leaders, AKA the bench, potential, and then you have the chosen one, and then you have everyone else. And it's almost though that everyone has 100% responsibility, because the leader has to have trained properly. That's responsibility. The person who steps in the role has to have already earned the trust. Back to what you were talking about earlier, trust mm-hmm. and accountability, and showing they have the capabilities. So they have 100% responsibility. And then those that are not going to be that leader are still leaders. So they still have the responsibility to 100% responsibility to move a company forward or an initiative forward or whatever the case may be. Again, I go back to this. It makes me suddenly think about succession planning in a very different way. It's not even the right term.
There's a part in my book where I talk about Rob and I. We're getting exhausted. We're in Afghanistan, and doing unconventional warfare is exhausting. Doing village stability operations is exhausting because you're out in the middle of nowhere, and your camp is in the middle of a little city or a village with no one around. There's no bigger military around to support you. You're on your own. And so it's 24/7, 365 days a year. And so not only are you working by, through, and with the local population, you're also at night going out and, you know, we were conducting operations. And so Rob and I were getting exhausted. We were, you know, doing essentially, he'd be out with half the crew and I'd be back at the compound monitoring communications for him. And then fast forward, I'd be out and he'd be monitoring communications for me. And so he and I were just getting smoked. We were exhausted. And finally we said, hey, we can't, this is unsustainable. We cannot do this anymore. And so what we started doing is we started getting very quickly, getting our next guys ready so they could step in. And we created a rotation of six of us so that if, you know, if heaven forbid, if something were to happen to me, Johnny or Bobby would be ready to step into the role, you know, but it didn't happen overnight. It took us months to get to that point. It took us months, but eventually we did. And sure enough, we were a well-oiled machine. And then how this plays out, right? Fast forward a year later, we come back to America and we captured all of our findings. We wrote it all down and we helped Naval Special Warfare stand up a new course of instruction for new junior leaders that were going to be facing that same situation on the battlefield.
And then you also realize, wow, corporate America needs this. Small, medium, big, global,
sure.
Regional, doesn't matter.
That's right.
That is then the nature of what someone would find in this book, correct? The perspectives,
right. Amen.
The insights that you've gained. I get what you're saying, and I have such a tremendous appreciation for it. What would a CEO gain by working with you and your team, by reading this book? What are two or three things that you think could really make a difference for someone running a company these days?
We like to say we make work fun. That's what we focus on. You know, we spend 40, 60 hours a week together. Like, why can't we make it fun? And, you know, ever since I got interested around organizational culture, I noticed something. I could walk into, you know, the Googles, the Facebooks of the world, or I could walk into a manufacturing facility. a metals facility, a materials facility, a plumbing shop, you know, an auto manufacturer. My point is, I can list 100 industries.
Yes.
That I've walked into, and they're either, oh, I would never want to be here. All industries, not just the big sexy ones that everyone thinks. Yeah, they, I would never want to be here. Or, you know, something that's not sexy,
yeah,
per se, that I've walked into. I'm like, this is amazing.
Uh-huh.
Oh my gosh, I want to work here. This is amazing. What's going on here? Oh, it's the culture. It's the team that's making work fun, because they were intentional around defining what they want to be. Our book is broken into three sections. It's around, hey, defining where you want to be as an organization, as a culture, and then actually developing that culture. And then lastly is sustaining and improving over time, slow incremental improvement through sustainment. And so that's what these organizations have done. And so that's what we do, is we work alongside, you know, COOs, CHROs, and CEOs to help them do just that.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what is it that sort of drives you within, that causes you to care about this, that caused you to care about your team, that platoon, that caused you to care about those villages that the prior day were shooting down the helicopter with our Superman in it? What is it that really is in the underneath?
Well, we have such an amazing nation. We have our problems. We're not perfect. We are far from perfect. I get it, everybody. A lot of people will think, okay, you know, this is what we have running for our country's leadership. I get it. Not my point. My point is that, yes, we're not perfect, but we are a pretty great nation with pretty great founding principles. But 85% of this nation hates work.
Yeah.
85% of this nation hates their boss, hates their job. And it doesn't have to be that way. Back to my point of, I've seen, you know, in hundreds of industries, both sides, either a place that no one wants to be at, or I've seen in every industry, a place that everyone's like, dude, we love coming to work. I've seen it in every industry, not just the ones that you might think everyone wants to be a part of. Not just, you know, the entertainment industry or high tech or the new AI or new or crypto. I've seen horrific cultures in all of those. And I've seen amazing cultures in old organization or old industries that you might think was very old and staunchy.
Yes.
I've seen amazing in both. And so my point of why I bring that up is, when you realize and you're able to build that, and it's fun and people love coming to do it, the world's a much better place. And then that's where we get to see innovation. That's where innovation happens, when people love coming to work every day.
I can't think of a better end note here, Kyle. And as you were saying that, it made me think, there's probably CEOs that would like to come to work more than they do,
right?
Because they know it. They know something,
right,
but aren't quite,
right,
sure the solution. So you've offered a potential pathway, a potential resource to help find that joy for the team and for the CEO as well. So thank you so much for joining me in this episode. It has been a delight to host you. And I'm looking forward to reading your book very thoroughly and catching your next one, whenever that one comes out.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
You're welcome.
Be sure to subscribe in all your favorite podcast apps. Just look for Success Beneath the Surface. Chief Outsiders, part-time growth executives with full-time results.